Coming up is the news.
The headlines here on Slam: South Korean president anti-Iranian and interventionist remarks, saying that it expects an explanation from Seoul. Over a dozen universities and colleges across the Israeli-occupied territories witnessed fresh protests. And teachers in England and Wales are planning to go on strike as the UK faces a wave of industrial action by nurses. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmati, and these are our top stories this hour. Foreign Ministry has strongly reacted to the South Korean president calling Iran the enemy of the UAE. It slammed the comments as diplomatically invalid and meddlesome. The ministry spokesman says that the remarks show a failure to fully grasp the historical and friendly relations between Iran and the Persian Gulf littoral states, including the UAE. Nasser Kanani says that those relations are positive and fast-moving. He added that Iran is now awaiting an explanation from the Seoul of South Korea, the government, in the UAE on Sunday. South Korean president alleged that Iran is the biggest threat to the Arab country. Yook Soo-yeol made these remarks during a visit to the contingent of South Korea Special Forces in the UAE. Meanwhile, South Koreans have questioned a massive arms and nuclear deal with the United Arab Emirates, which was boosted during President Yoon Suk-yeol's trip in Abu Dhabi. The UAE has already purchased a $3.5 billion weapons package from South Korea. Many oppose these arms sales, saying that such measures would only foment conflicts in the world. Our correspondent Frank Smith reports.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol visited the United Arab Emirates this week to boost trade ties. South Korea is constructing 4 nuclear reactors for the UAE as President Yoon supports a return to nuclear energy.
Korea has also declared its 2050 carbon neutrality goal. To achieve this goal, we're working to rapidly restore the nuclear power system, which supplies carbon-free electricity, and boost the supply of clean energy, such as renewable energy and hydrogen energy.
President Yoon also seeks to boost weapons exports to the UAE on the heels of a $3.5 billion deal for a South Korean anti-ballistic missile system. This despite a controversial surveillance lapse in South Korea. President Yoon and the South Korean military have been under intense criticism following a recent incursion of 5 North Korean drones across the border. President Yoon and his wife Sunday visited a detachment of South Korean soldiers stationed in the UAE since 2011. South Korea has become a major arms exporter of fighter jets, tanks, and guided missiles, which have found prominent use in the war in Yemen. South Koreans, however, view such weapons sales with caution.
It's good to sell weapons in terms of earning foreign currency through our exports, but it's not good if those weapons are then actually used in a war.
I know that area has had a lot of conflict and war, so I think selling weapons there will just make the situation worse.
South Korea is now the world's 7th largest arms dealer, with prominent exports to Southeast Asia, Poland, and Saudi Arabia. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Protests are continuing against the new far-right Israeli cabinet by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, with thousands of students joining in. Protests were held in over a dozen university and colleges and campuses, including in Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Al-Quds. They left their classes, student status, to stage a coordinated strike against the cabinet plans for the so-called judicial reforms. Four of the students were arrested in Al-Quds, with protest organizers complaining about bullying by police forces. The new Israeli cabinet is under public fire for its attempt to decrease the power of the Supreme Court. It is now in favor. This is aimed at the Prime Minister's own efforts to dodge the charges of bribery and fraud against him.
Israel is experiencing unprecedented mass protests. Tens of thousands of Israelis have hit the streets in several cities, including Tel Aviv, Al-Quds, and Haifa, for the second consecutive week to protest against plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to implement changes to Israel's legal system and weaken the Supreme Court. The demonstration presents an early challenge to Netanyahu and his far-right minister, Etmar Ben-Gvir, who has ordered police to take tough action if protesters block roads or display Palestinian flags. In defiance of Ben-Gvir's call, some footage showed Palestinian flags on display. The crowd in Tel Aviv swelled to more than 80,000 people despite rainy weather there. Demonstrators, many covered by umbrellas, held signs and chanted slogans like criminal government or the end of democracy. But what were they protesting that gave way to such a large crowd to come out?
We would like to say that the current coalition in Israel would like to change the regime to make us like a dark regime in the world, and we will not accept it and will fight for this democracy.
The focus of the protests was how the new coalition cabinet, headed by Netanyahu, wants to decrease the power of the Supreme Court in its own favor. This as Netanyahu is trying to escape charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The situation has already angered Israeli officials, including the president. Herzog also warned that Israel faced, quote, a historic constitutional crisis over the contested judicial reform plan. But despite all that criticism, Netanyahu has pledged to complete legislating the reforms in a way that will correct what needs correcting, totally protect individual rights, as he claims, and restore the public's faith in the justice system that so much requires such reform. The legal changes could help Netanyahu evade eviction of corruption or even make his trial disappear entirely.
Israel is grappling with numerous issues. The regime faces the challenge posed by the rise of new Palestinian resistance groups, as well as a biting cost of living crisis and internal political divisions. All of these point to a question whether Israel is riding for a fall, especially seeing the comments by former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who warned back in May that the regime could disintegrate before its 80th anniversary.
In office for more than just 2 weeks, Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing cabinet has launched proposals to weaken the Supreme Court by giving parliament the power to overturn court decisions with a simple majority vote. It also wants to give parliament control over the appointment of judges and reduce the independence of legal advisors. Israeli opposition leaders, former attorneys general, and the president of Israel's Supreme Court have all spoken out against the plan. They said a move would cripple judicial independence, foster corruption, set back minority rights, and deprive Israel's courts of credibility that helps fend off war crimes abroad. Critics said the changes could help Netanyahu evade conviction in his corruption trial or make the trial disappear altogether. But are these protests against Netanyahu himself? Netanyahu's premiership in the past has been fraught not only with trying to escape corruption charges, but also violations like Palestinian rights, settlement construction, and other hot-button issues that exist between Palestinians and Israel. Inside Israel, the opposition against the current right-wing cabinet and Netanyahu is so high and elevated that a new movement has been created to promote and encourage Israelis to leave Israel, with a group planning to move 10,000 Israeli Jews in the first stage of its project. Meanwhile, grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime. Den of Lions is one, an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. In the meantime, the current right-wing cabinet and its far-right minister Ben-Gvir are advocating more violence against Palestinians, which would lead to more deaths, including violations like settlement buildings, changing the demographics of Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds, and other core issues. The cost of living is one other major issue protesters are angry with. After all, Israel is expensive and has one of the highest costs of living in the world. With all the crises the regime is grappling with, what seems to be on the corner for officials in Tel Aviv is what a protester said during a Saturday demonstration. "I came here to demonstrate against the anti-democratic steps of the new cabinet. This can be the start of the end of the Jewish state as we know it. Is this cabinet igniting the start of the end of Israel?" This exactly signifies what former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak expressed concern about: the survival of Israel. Barak said the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. He said throughout the Jewish history, the Jews did not rule for more than 80 years, except in the two kingdoms of David and the Hasmonean dynasty. And in both periods, their disintegration began in the 8th decade.
In the UK, teachers and nurses are set to go on a wage strike and a fresh headache for the government. Over 23,000 schools in England and Wales will be impacted by the teacher strike planned for February the 1st. In Scotland, they have stopped working, which is close to many allies. Britain's largest education union says the government's offer 5% rise. In fact, the wage cut due to spiraling prices. Tens of thousands of nurses in England are also planning strikes in February. Their trade unions say the stoppage will take place if progress is not made by the end of this month in negotiations with the gourmet months of strikes across the various sectors. They have caused widespread disruption in the UK, which is suffering from a decades high government and government issues and is unable to afford big wages. The Ukrainian soldiers have arrived in the United States to receive training on how to use the missile system. The personnel now at the military school in the state of Oklahoma say Kiev has not disclosed the size of the consignment, but the Pentagon has put their number at up to 100. It said that the course will take several months. The U.S. announced late last month that it was ready to send Patriot missile systems to Ukraine, to the country, to counter Russian attacks. Russia has warned against the deployment of the system. The Kremlin says that any crew accompanying would be, quote, legitimate priority targets for the Russian military. Meanwhile, EU faces economic uncertainty in 2023 due to the gas supply issues and energy sanctions against Russia are backfiring to some extent. The European Commission has acknowledged, Jerem Hughes reports from Brussels.
On Monday, Eurozone finance ministers marked the occasion of Croatia becoming the 20th member of the Eurogroup. However, Zagreb joins the Euro at a very precarious time for the currency. The big question is, where will the EU get its gas in 2023 and at what price?
While high storage levels and lower demand have helped to bring energy prices down, the crisis is certainly not over.
The EU insists its move to cut out Russian energy over the war in Ukraine has damaged Moscow. But for the first time, there's an acknowledgement of collateral damage.
If you are cutting trade, if you are cutting imports, exports, the bilateral relations with the partner with whom you had a lot of to do with before, then of course there is some negative impact on our side.
Experts say the EU has always been overly dependent on imports of gas, oil and raw materials. It's a reality that won't change.
They all have to be imported in a way that other regions don't. And that means that the European Union is very vulnerable, and it also has to look very carefully where it makes geostrategic alliances.
To obtain essential supplies, the EU will turn a blind eye to crimes committed by the likes of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, according to analysts. Despite enormous economic uncertainty at home, the EU is promising more financial aid for Ukraine.
We will continue to provide strong military, financial, diplomatic and political support to Ukraine and to the Ukrainian people. Together, the EU and its member states have contributed nearly 50 billion euros.
The European Commission has already organised 18 billion euro for Ukraine in 2023. The first tranche is currently being released. The EU will send a further 3 billion euro to Ukraine on Tuesday. As social inequality grows across the bloc, more and more people are asking, can we really afford to keep doing this? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The European Union maintains its close embrace and material support for the Zionist regime and its most hardline lobbyists, effectively giving Tel Aviv a green light to continue or even accelerate the destruction and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, "The Zionist regime is ignoring the European Union's request for compensation for its destruction and theft of EU-funded projects in the occupied West Bank, and Brussels is doing absolutely nothing about it." This less than entirely surprising revelation came in a response from the European Commission, the EU's executive arm, to a question from 24 members of the European Parliament. The lawmakers pointed out that since 2016, the Zionist regime has demolished EU-funded structures in the occupied West Bank, including East Al-Quds, valued at almost $2.5 million. In June alone, occupation forces delivered demolition or stop work orders to more than 50 structures funded by the EU or individual member states, valued at another $250,000. This was the highest number of aid structures placed at risk of demolition in a single month since the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs began keeping track, the lawmakers observed. In the last two decades, according to estimates by one human rights group, the Zionist regime has destroyed EU-funded projects to the tune of tens of millions of dollars. Brussels has repeatedly asked the Zionist regime to pay for the destruction of EU taxpayer-funded property, but the lawmakers noted that the Commission admitted that the use of diplomatic and political channels has not been successful. As a result, the lawmakers said Israel has seen no repercussions for illegal demolitions and human rights abuses. This impunity remains intact, according to Janez Lenarisic, the European Commissioner who responded to the lawmakers' question. On a number of occasions, Israel was requested to return or compensate for EU-funded assets that have been demolished, dismantled or confiscated by Israel, Lenarisic said, but that has met with no success. Lenarisic reaffirmed that the EU sees the demolitions and the Zionist regime's colonization of occupied Palestinian land as illegal. Nonetheless, a list of possible options to secure compensation from the Zionist regime for EU funding lost in demolitions has not been discussed, Lenarisic admitted. This relaxed approach contrasts with how Brussels regularly meets out punishments to other countries. We have an EU that sanctions, isolates and condemns countless nations around the world for perceived infringements of human rights and sometimes even targeting people in countries for electing leaders that EU financial capital perceives to be a threat to its interest. Mick Wallace, one of the European Parliament members who co-signed the question, told the Electronic Intifada. Wallace, who represents Ireland as part of the left parliamentary grouping, said the crimes of these nations put together wouldn't come close to the horrors perpetrated by the Israelis against Palestinian people. Passing the buck, Lenarisic told the lawmakers that it is for the Council acting by unanimity to decide on a possible adoption of EU restrictive measures. The EU Council, made up of representatives of the bloc's governments, is indeed responsible for adopting restrictive measures, EU jargon for sanctions. But EU procedure is that decisions on the adoption, renewal or lifting of sanctions regimes are taken by the Council of the European Union on the basis of proposals from the High Representative of the Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy. The High Representative, effectively the EU's Foreign Minister, currently Joseph Borrell, is something of an institutional hybrid. As well as heading a diplomatic service, Borrell is part of the European Commission. What this boils down to is that the first step would be for the Commission itself to draw up a list of proposed sanctions against the Zionist regime, which Lenarisic admits the body has not done. Borrell recently admitted that the EU is effectively a puppet of Washington, which may help explain his inaction. So, what is Brussels doing apart from offering lip service? According to Lenarisic, the EU is engaging in public advocacy that includes frequent visits of various sites in the occupied Palestinian territory by diplomats. That's obviously a reference to the regular photo ops staged by EU diplomats, which do absolutely nothing to restrain the Zionist regime, but serve to falsely whitewash Brussels as some sort of protector and defender of Palestinian rights. Much of the recent destruction has been in Masafer Yatar, an area south of Al-Khalil. That is a focus of the Zionist regime's ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, land theft and settler colonization. The Israeli regime military this month revealed that it plans to imminently expel 1,000 Palestinians from the area, half of them children. That is a war crime. Yet despite this, Brussels maintains its close embrace and material support for the fabricated regime of Israel and its most hardline lobbyists, effectively giving Tel Aviv a green light to continue or even accelerate the destruction and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. Lawmaker Mick Wallace said no matter what the Israeli administration does, even when they wantonly bomb and destroy EU-funded infrastructure, the EU weapons contracts keep coming. The grants, investments and funding keep coming. He added there can be no other conclusion than this. The brutality that the increasingly far-right Israeli regime apparatus perpetrates against humanity in Palestine and beyond is completely in line with EU values.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, let us ponder on a brilliant description of the Holy Quran by Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, the last and most comprehensive heavenly scripture that God Almighty revealed to her father, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. A covenant he brought unto you, and an heir he left to guard you. That is the eloquent book of Allah, the truthful Quran. The brilliant light, the shining beam, its insights are indisputable, its secrets are revealed, its indications are manifest, and its followers are blessed by it.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at an important aspect of the Islamic identity, and that is Salah. The five daily prayers to begin with, and all the other prayers that are called Salah, are an important part of the Muslim's identity. And a Muslim must take the time to not only pray properly, but also take the time and effort to inculcate and nurture Salah in the lives of his children. And again, we find throughout the Islamic traditions, the emphasis has been always there to take Salah and nurture it gradually into the lives of the children, and also with a lot of patience, perseverance, with verbal reminders, with practical demonstrations, and so on. But we find two processes. On one hand, the process of reward and encouragement is very important. And on the other hand, taking the children to task at certain stages is also an important strategy, because this will balance the way the children move forward. But we know for sure that the process of taking the children to task and having consequences as well will allow for them to stand balanced on the straight path and proceed on the middle way. And as we find from the lifestyle of the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, that they would encourage their companions to teach them salah. And when they're 8 years old, they even told their companions to take their children to task if they did not pray salah. And at times, in extreme cases, when children would even then not pay attention to salah, we're told in a narration from Imam al-Baqir or Imam al-Sadiq, one of them, that Abdullah ibn Fawwala narrates that when a child is 7 years old, that child should be told to wash his face and hands, not exactly in the state of wudu, but similar to the state of wudu, and thereafter pray salah, and then slowly and gradually, till 9 years are complete, the child learns how to pray salah. But once he or she is 9 years old, one should teach their children the proper method of performing wudu, and if the wudu is not performed after reminders properly, then the child should be taken to task and there should be consequences for it. And then a child should be commended. They should be commanded to pray salah. They should be enjoined towards salah. And if they do not, then again, there should be consequences in place. Now, if a child at the age of 9 and thereafter knows how to perform wudu and to pray salah, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala at that moment and in that phase will, because of the wudu and salah of the child, will forgive the parents of that child. So indeed it shows us how important it is to teach our children through reward and encouragement primarily and excessively on one hand. But in certain instances when things do not move forward and the children need to be taken to task, it is permissible to take them to task and have consequences in place. But keeping in mind from the general lifestyle of the Holy Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, the method of encouragement and reward would take precedence in any case. And the frequency of reward and encouragement is always more than the use of taking the children to task and having consequences for them. And rather, it is only in specific conditions with specific minute details that a person is allowed to take children to task and have severe consequences for them. Rather, the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam have constantly encouraged in normal circumstances to use the reward and encouragement method. I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
I just told you that all options are on the table.
I have said repeatedly, and I will say today, we are not taking any options off the table. Rest assured, we will take no options off the table.
No options off the table means I'm considering all options.
Can you tell us exactly what those options might be?
No.
The assassination option.
Somebody is killing Iranian nuclear scientists. Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan murdered along with his driver in broad daylight in Tehran traffic.
One of Iran's top nuclear scientists has been killed in a car bombing in the capital, Tehran.
Two motorcyclists tracked the car through Tehran's morning rush hour, lobbing a magnetic bomb right at Roshan. A mission that seemed right out of a spy thriller like Syriana.
It has all the earmarks of an Israeli operation, very sophisticated, very particular, and very effective.
People are killing Iranian nuclear scientists in a very clear pattern. Sir, who do you think is behind it?
We believe that these terrorist attacks are supported by some elements in especially within the Israeli regime, as well as some quarters around the world.
And what about Israel? What reaction today?
You know, Diane, we've been looking for responses from Israel all day, and where did we find it? Facebook, with the Israeli Defense Force spokesman saying, I don't know who settled the score with the Iranian scientist, but I am certainly not shedding a tear, not exactly a denial there.
Nuclear scientist Dariush Rezainejad was assassinated on the 23rd of July 2011. On the afternoon he died, his wife and five-year-old daughter were in the car with him. He was 32. Fereydoon Abbasi was attacked on the 29th of November 2010 as head of Iran's Atomic Energy Agency on his way to the university where he taught nuclear physics. The 53-year-old survived the attack. He says the fact that Iranian scientists are asked to give so much personal information when they travel speaks volumes in itself. On the same day and at almost exactly the same time, another assassination attack was being launched on the other side of town. 40-year-old Majid Shahriari was the target. He and his wife were on their way to the university where they both taught when a bomb was attached to their car. Shahriari was killed, his wife survived, but with serious injuries. She still bears the scars of that day. She says before the attack, they had received many death threats. In the past years, there have been five assassination attacks targeting Iranian nuclear scientists in Iran. Four were successful and one failed. The number of attacks and the way they were launched show a trend. So what entity or entities are responsible for these attacks?
Maximum covert operations to block and disrupt the Iranian program, including taking out their scientists, including breaking up their systems, all of it covertly, all of it deniable. Second, maximum coordination with the Israelis. In a way which allows them to maximize their impact in Iran. Third, absolute strategic program comparable to what President Reagan, Pope John Paul II, and Margaret Thatcher did to the Soviet Union, of every possible aspect short of war, of breaking the regime and bringing it down.
Mark Perry is an American intelligence and foreign affairs analyst based in Washington.
These are sophisticated operations. They're not suicide bombings. The most recent incident was a magnetic bomb, so I would say it's clear that it was an outside intelligence agency. And Leon Panetta, our Secretary of Defense, has said he has a pretty good idea of who did it, and I think he was hinting that it was the Israelis.
Iran has been threatened and sanctioned over its nuclear energy program. 5 assassination attacks have been launched on Iranian nuclear scientists, and now the drums of war can be heard coming from the West. So are the countries pressuring Iran really worried about Iran having nuclear power, or is the problem something else?
Get more on this now from RT's Peter Oliver. Peter, what exactly did Vladimir Putin say?
Well, he was really addressing his standpoint on key foreign policy issues. Iran was also on the lips of the Prime Minister. For a few years now, we've seen criticism of Russia's decision to build a nuclear power plant in Iran. Vladimir Putin saying this, The allegations that Iran was developing nuclear weapons was being used as an excuse to try and initiate regime change in the country.
Public perception is very important in all this. To take such drastic steps against another country, the nations involved have to be geared up to accept such an event. Iran's nuclear energy program has been the center of a lot of Western media attention. It's been labeled a nuclear weapons program, and Israeli director Alex Trayman has made a documentary called Iranium to brand that label on the public psyche.
Ronald Reagan helped a lot with the collapse of the Soviet Union by calling them an evil empire and saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It's very much in the interests of the people of Iran, as well as all of Iran's neighbors and us, for us to do everything humanly possible to get this regime to collapse before it gets a nuclear weapon.
2 + 2 = 4. Israel feels threatened by Iran. It said it would do anything to protect its country. Unlike the United States, the Mossad does not have a prohibition against assassination. Clearly, they want to be able to react to the Iranian threat in any manner they can, up to and including assassinations.
Israel has kept quiet over the assassination of Iranian scientists, but the US, Israel's staunch supporter, has been quite vocal about the whole thing. US presidential candidates say if that's what it takes, so be it.
You have to take whatever steps are necessary to break its capacity to have a nuclear weapon.
And it appears obvious to me that the administration is doing little to nothing. Now, I'm hopeful that some of the things we're seeing with respect to the nuclear program that the United States is involved with, which is on occasion scientists working on the nuclear program in Iran turn up dead. I think that's a wonderful thing, Ken. I think we should send a very clear message that if you are a scientist from Russia or from North Korea or from Iran and you're going to work on the nuclear program to develop a nuclear bomb from Iran, you are not safe. And if people say, well, you can't go out and assassinate people, well, tell that to Al-Awlaki. Yeah. Okay? We've done it. We've done it for an American citizen.
I want to categorically deny any United States involvement in any kind of act of violence inside Iran.
Various entities are feeding off the political narrative surrounding Iran's nuclear program, from the media to weapons companies. It's a topic that has influenced global prices, is being used as a tool in elections, and even as an excuse for insurance companies that trade in and around Iran to push up prices. and certain groups that have also been fighting against the Iranian government for years have hooked their wagon up to this caravan.
Remember, this all started when we found them enriching uranium in an undeclared fashion. And it happened because somebody told on them. There was an Iranian group that brought forth the information.
A former United Nations weapons inspector in Iraq says Israel and the MKO are collaborating.
The question is, did that information, was it sourced by the MKO itself, or was the MKO used as a vehicle to provide this information to the public? There's reason to believe that in the case of the Natanz information, that this information was actually a product of a third agency, an outside party, Israel, which developed this intelligence, and then Israel used the MKO as the vehicle to spread this information because of the MKO's past record of having intelligence information relevant to the Islamic Republic.
Do you believe that the Israelis are working with the People's Mujahideen of Iran? Do you believe Israel is working with Iranian dissidents?
I would say this. Iran is highly alert to the possibility of Israelis infiltrating it with false identities, trying to kill people, sabotage the Iranian nuclear project. And therefore, it is very hard for Israelis to work in Iran. And it might. That unlike the history of most of the history of Israeli intelligence, where these operations were conducted on a, quote, blue and white principle, which is the colors of the flags of Israel, meaning only Israeli citizens, only Jews participate in such an operation. Maybe in Iran, the case is different because Iran is a different territory and very hard to work in. When you got such a territory, you might think to recruit locals upon your own people.
By its own admission, the West considers all the options to be on the table. Threats, sanctions, assassinations, and now the drums of war. Iran says Western think tanks are employing rather feeble strategies and are grossly mistaken in their calculations regarding Iran and the Iranian nation. Of course, the tactics being used against Iran can only succeed if the international community buys into all the hype and propaganda surrounding Iran.
You take a look at Iran and you realize that there's a number of patterns in place that are the exact replica of what had occurred with Iraq. I realized that the United States was playing the exact same game with Iran, manufacturing an artificial crisis over Iran's nuclear weapons program. And then you have a track record of the United States exaggerating a case of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and now you take a look at the case they're making with Iran and you realize that the same pattern is at play, that the United States is manufacturing a false premise for confronting Iran. For what reason? Regime change.
Mind you, the international community did just that back in 2001 and 2003 when the West attacked Afghanistan and Iraq.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The White House says lawyers for President Joe Biden found more classified documents at his home in Wilmington, Delaware, than previously known. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. ABC News has covered the story and tells us more. Lawyers for President Joe Biden found more classified documents at his home in Wilmington, Delaware, than previously known, the White House acknowledged on Saturday, 14th of January. White House lawyer Richard Sober said in a statement that a total of 6 pages of classified documents were found during a search of Joe Biden's private library. The White House had said previously that only a single page was found there. The latest disclosure is in addition to the discovery of documents found in December in President Biden's garage and in November at his former offices at the Penn Biden Center in Washington from his time as vice president. The apparent mishandling of classified documents and official records from the Obama administration is under investigation by a former U.S. attorney, Robert Hur, who was appointed as a special counsel on Thursday by Attorney General Merrick Garland. Richard Sober said in a statement on Saturday, 14th of January, that Biden's personal lawyers, who did not have security clearances, stopped their search after finding the first page on Wednesday evening, 11th of January. Richard Sober found the remaining material on Thursday as he was facilitating their retrieval by the Department of Justice. While I was transferring it to the Department of Justice officials who accompanied me, 5 additional pages with classification markings were discovered. Among the material with it, for a total of 6 pages, Sober said. The Department of Justice officials with me immediately took possession of them. Sober, who previously said that the White House was confident that a thorough review will show that these documents were inadvertently misplaced and the president and his lawyers acted promptly upon discovery of this mistake. Richard Sober's statement did not explain why the White House waited 2 days to provide an updated accounting of the number of classified records. The White House is already facing scrutiny for waiting more than 2 months to acknowledge the discovery of the initial group of documents at the Biden office. On Thursday, 12th of January, asked whether Biden could guarantee that additional classified documents would not turn up in a further search, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre told reporters, "You should assume that it's been completed. Yes." Sober reiterated on Saturday that the White House would cooperate with Hur's investigation. Bob Bauer, the president's personal lawyer, said his legal team has attempted to balance the importance of public transparency where appropriate with established norms and limitations necessary to protect the investigation's integrity. The Justice Department historically imposes a high legal bar before bringing criminal charges in cases involving the mishandling of classified information, with a requirement that someone intended to break the law as opposed to being merely careless or negligent in doing so. The primary statute governing the illegal removal and retention of classified documents makes it a crime to knowingly remove classified documents and store them in an unauthorized way. The circumstances involving Joe Biden, at least as far as known, differ from a separate investigation into the mishandling of classified documents at former President Donald Trump's private club and residence in Florida. In Trump's case, Special Counsel Jack Smith is investigating whether anyone sought to obstruct the investigation into the retention of classified records at the Palm Beach estate. Justice Department officials have said Donald Trump's representatives failed to fully comply with a subpoena. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the story. The latest development appears to bring the total number of documents marked classified and found at President Biden's home in Wilmington, Delaware, and former office to at least 20. The trove is understood to include material categorized as top secret, among approximately 10 documents discovered at the University of Pennsylvania's Biden Center for Diplomacy, a think tank in the Capitol named after him. A federal law enforcement official familiar with the investigation into the discoveries told CBS News on Saturday. The latest revelations prompted Andrew Weissman, former federal prosecutor and senior member of the special counsel Robert Mueller's team that investigated Donald Trump's links with Moscow during his 2016 presidential campaign, to tweet, "This may explain why the White House has not been transparent with the public about exactly what documents were found." He did not elaborate, but, like other analysis, previously had drawn a clear distinction between the situation with documents retained from Biden's time and Donald Trump's hoarding of boxes of secret documents from his presidency, despite federal requests for all material to be returned, which prompted the FBI to raid his Florida residence last summer. Joe Biden's legal team voluntarily turned the documents found over to federal officials after they were discovered last November. "Let's remember that what we are correctly asking the current White House to do, be as transparent as possible about what happened and when, is something that Donald Trump has not done at all to this day with respect to the Mar-a-Lago docs, other than put out a series of lies," Andrew Weissman tweeted on Thursday. Donald Trump and Joe Biden are now both under investigation by separate special counsels at the request of the Department of Justice. House Republicans, now in control of the lower chamber of Congress, on Friday announced an investigation of Joe Biden by the Judiciary Committee. The current White House explanation for President Biden's situation, offered by Richard Sober, is that special counsel's inquiry will show that these documents were inadvertently misplaced, a mistake with the nation's secrets after the former vice president's office was hastily packed up at the end of the Obama administration just before Donald Trump took office. Richard Painter, the top ethics official in the George W. Bush administration, called such behavior incredibly careless and really quite shocking, but emphasized that President Biden probably would avoid the criminal issues looming over Donald Trump because there is so far no sense that President Biden intentionally mishandled classified records.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, and we shall also look at, in the backdrop of tumultuous Sino-India relations and border tensions, China's recent interest in rebooting relations with India. We will discuss BJP government in New Delhi formalizing new rules to change the demography of the Muslim-majority state of Jammu and Kashmir.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi recently stated that Beijing is willing to work with India to improve bilateral ties, extending an olive branch to the regional foe. His remarks suggest China